Ready for a new and exciting career challenge? At DHL Supply Chain, you're part of a team committed to creating innovative solutions for some of the biggest brands in the world. We're recognized as a best place to work, where people are valued, supported, and respected. DHL Supply Chain is hiring for a wide range of salaried operational and functional roles. Previous experience in logistics is welcome, but not required. All opportunities, no boundaries. DHL Supply Chain. Apply today at joindhl.com.
Hey everyone, it's Ted from Consumer Cellular, the guy in the orange sweater, and this is your wake-up call. If you're paying too much for wireless service, you don't have to keep having that nightmare. Consumer Cellular has the same fast, reliable coverage as the leading carriers for less. And for a limited time, new customers receive their second month free when they sign up and use promo code MONTHFREE by May 31st. So why keep spending more than you have to? Seriously, wake up and call 1-888-FREEDOM or visit ConsumerCellular.com.
Taxes, fees, and other third-party charges will apply. See website for additional details.
The news cycle is being dominated by a president who was completely out of control and seemed eager to start a nuclear war. And I think a lot of the reaction I saw to it then was just fun, aliens. That's a very human thing to want to find something sort of lighter and kind of goofy when the news is like that. And I think it also helped that it wasn't very polarized. That Marco Rubio and Harry Reid both are really into aliens. If we knew what the aliens wanted to do on capital gains taxes, maybe there'd be like a real divide there. But are there aliens seems fairly neutral.
Welcome to Offline. I'm Jon Favreau.
I'm Max Fisher.
And you just heard from today's guest, senior correspondent at Vox, Dylan Matthews. It's conspiracy theory week here at Offline.
Oh my God, is it?
We're going to talk about a listener named Kate, who's taken the Offline challenge a little too seriously.
She's doing great, though. Her screen time numbers are amazing.
Very low.
Yeah.
Because it's been months since anyone has seen or heard from the Princess of Wales and future Queen of England. Where the hell is she? Why did she post a heavily photoshopped, maybe even fake Mother's Day picture on Twitter?
Oh.
And why can't we all stop talking about it?
I can't give it up.
Me neither, man. Then after the break, Max, I know you talked to your old colleague at Vox, Dylan Matthews, about another conspiracy theory that took the internet by storm, the Pentagon's 2021 UFO report, which is a fascinating story with cameos from former Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid, the drummer of Blink 182, didn't know that, and a handful of reporters at the New York Times. How was the conversation?
So he's actually the guitarist and lead singer from Blink 182.
Oh, wow. Misinformation right here in the
screen. It was great. So I have been on my soapbox for years that all of these like UFO stories that have been running in the New York Times for the past 6-7 years, like they're just fake. They're just not real. And I think if you know the story of like the backstory of how this like UFO thing came to dominate news coverage, or like how it came into news coverage like this, I think it all becomes very clear. So I was very happy to finally get the backstory of that out there.
That's great. Okay, cool. Yeah, I've always Harry Reid was always on this, RIP, but he was always this. He was like the big UFO guy. And when I was in the White House, it was always like, oh, well, Harry Reid is a real UFO.
It turns out there's a big money donor story behind his involvement in UFOs, too. It's what it all comes back to.
Oh, this is fascinating. Okay, I'm going to listen. Before we get to all that, a potential ban on TikTok in the United States is one step closer to becoming reality. Mm-hmm. The House of Representatives, by an overwhelming bipartisan vote of 352-65, they don't even vote like that to fund the government. To keep themselves being paid.
They've been listening to Offline. They know social media is bad.
So the passed legislation that would force ByteDance to sell the popular video app to an American buyer or face a possible ban from the app stores. Mm-hmm. Joe Biden has said he'll sign the legislation, but first it needs to pass the Senate, where it must overcome opposition from a horde of angry TikTokers, an army of lobbyists, and a strange mix of politicians in both parties, including Donald Trump. So, Max, we talked about this last week, but the legislation has moved so quickly. Mm-hmm. So I think it's worth checking back in. Do you think this will actually end up on Biden's desk?
I think the honest truth is that we don't know. A lot of senators have been very mum about whether or not they will support it. The two chairs of the Intelligence Committee, Marco Rubio and Mark Warner, have said they will support it.
Offline guest, Mark Warner, who talked about this a year ago on this very program.
He has been very on this issue, yeah. But Chuck Schumer will not even say whether he will bring it up for a vote. So clearly there is a lot of like backroom negotiation happening within the Senate. And I think it's just legitimately not clear whether they're going to vote it forward or not.
We're not in the prediction business here at Crooked Media.
However.
But I'll venture one for this. I think I lean no.
Really?
For a couple reasons. The Senate is extremely slow.
Yeah.
That's just how they are. I do think the political backlash or the concern about the political effects in an election year,
mm-hmm.
I think like it went through the House pretty fast, but I think there's going to be some worries on the Democratic side, especially.
Yeah. Do they want to be seen as the party that took away your TikTok?
Yes.
Yeah.
And then I'm trying to count, like, are there 60 votes, right? Because it's not just 50 votes. We have to be 60 votes in the Senate.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a lot. It's a lot of votes.
It does feel like the kind of issue where nobody wants to vote against, you know, making the Communist Party-linked company sell off the, like, bad-for-teen mental health app. But at the same time, nobody wants to be, like, holding the knife for taking away TikTok, which is extremely popular, especially with young people.
And even if you take away the politics, there are other competing bills. Like, I think Maria Cantwell has another bill in the Senate that's floating around that would actually like empower the Commerce Department, and it gets into a lot of technical details.
Right.
But there are different competing versions of what the best way to go about this is, and even the White House has said like they want to keep working on the legislation with people. So that makes me think and we're in an election year, and most business in Congress ends by the spring or summer of an election year. So I don't know. I don't know if it happens before the election.
If I had to put money down, which again, why am I making predictions? No one is forcing me to put money down. it's the pundit's fallacy here. It would be that they come out with some kind of compromise that we're going to do something like this Project Texas thing where they're required to like house the data centers in the U.S. or something like that. So they can say like, look, we solved the problem, but also we're not going to take this extreme step.
Yeah. So TikTokers have taken the ban less than well.
Yeah.
Creators have claimed that Congress is pushing this ban to silence the youth, deplatform small businesses, and even snuff out pro-Palestinian perspectives. Let's play some clips.
They're trying to ban TikTok because this app is pro-Palestinian.
This time they're not bluffing, and I wanted to know what was different, and I think it's because we did something that actually worked this time. Think about Starbucks, think about Kellogg, think about the fact that there's a list going around for how many other companies we plan on hitting.
They are voting to ban the complaint box rather than listen to a single complaint on this fucking app. They see us talking to each other. They see us seeing the humanity in each other's eyes. I don't care if you got a red hat or a fucking septum piercing. I hear your complaints and I see the world you're standing in.
Okay.
Wow.
Okay.
I know.
Let's take it down a notch.
It's definitely a big, like, I make a video on TikTok, therefore I'm the protagonist of American politics happening here.
But also, the like, this is a plan to snuff out pro-Palestinian perspectives. Like, if you want to see horrific images from this awful war, they are everywhere.
Sure.
They are not limited to TikTok.
Yeah.
It's all over the news.
Yeah. And protesters, actual physical real world protesters, have I think been much more effective at raising awareness around this than the people who are going viral on TikTok.
And to all the other points, people are arguing and yelling and seeing, I mean, show me the app where people are seeing humanity in each other, but but they're doing that everywhere. It's a little, I get it. If your experience and your only experience is or your main source of information and entertainment is TikTok, it feels quite existential.
Threatening.
I get that.
And I think, to be fair, my sense is that while there is certainly a faction of TikTok that says we are the most important political actors in the world, and therefore if they want to ban this app, it's because they hate how much change we're making. Mm. I do get the sense that the majority of energy on the app is much more reasonably like, I enjoy this app. There are funny videos on it. I don't want it taken away. It's a fun thing that I do to spend 45 minutes a day on. So, you know, don't take that away from me.
Yeah, on Twitter, the other hellhole of a social media platform that I'm addicted to.
Where we look into each other's eyes and see each other's humanity. Yeah.
Someone tweeted like, there's this very popular thread. Please post the TikTok videos that are the best argument for why it shouldn't be banned.
Sure.
And there have been, I'd say 90% of them are not political at all. They're just hilarious, funny, great, creative. So I get it. Mm-hmm. I get it. What do you think the arguments against a TikTok ban are that carry the most weight to you?
So I think there's actually a few. One is that there's not very much evidence that China would use TikTok to spy on Americans, something a lot of people have pointed out. Even people who are very concerned about TikTok otherwise. It's like, if China wants to get your data, there are better and easier ways for them to do it than using TikTok. Number two, political interference via the app, right? Like China leaning on ByteDance to lean on TikTok to manipulate our politics is certainly plausible, but I don't think it's been demonstrated that that is something that has happened. And so it's kind of a hypothetical concern more than something that's actually happening. The other, like those things aside, like number three, TikTok is just as bad as all the other social apps. So I think there's a very valid question to be raised here legally as well as just like politically within our debate. Like, why are we focusing on this one and not Meta, not the, not Instagram, not Facebook, not YouTube, which are just as bad on every other thing you might criticize TikTok on? This will entrench the dominance of those players. This is just going to make Meta and Google even more monopolistic than they already are, which is going to make the problems that those apps cause in our society any worse. And I number five, it's like, I don't hear people bring this up a lot, but I am very concerned about the escalatory precedent that this sets for relations between the U.S. and China. Mm. A huge concern that I had and a lot of like foreign policy people had the last couple of years is decoupling between the U.S. and China. Like every tit for tat step where we're breaking away our economic and political links with China and they're doing the same, where does that lead? Like I think taking another big step in that, and this is going to basically force China to then ban American companies in retaliation, or not force them, but they're full compelled to. And then are we going to do more of that? Are we going to start branding more Chinese companies? And I just like do not think that is a healthy direction to send this incredibly important bilateral relationship.
Yeah. I keep going back and forth on this. Like we have had rules in place, laws in place for quite some time that limit foreign ownership of American media companies and broadcast networks.
Yeah. TikTok, that is a compelling argument, I think.
TikTok is a broadcast network that 170 million Americans use. Yeah. It is gigantic.
Yeah.
And, you know, there's been arguments about like xenophobia or racism, but it's like, it's not about China. It's about the Chinese government. Like,
sure.
it's a sometimes brutal authoritarian regime.
Yeah.
And it's
quite
not,
often,
it's
you might
not
say.
Like, you know, it's not South Korea or Japan that has this company. We wouldn't be having this conversation then.
Yeah.
Or European country or most South America. Like, name your country. There's only a few that are truly authoritarian that we're concerned about. And the Chinese government is one of them. And the other thing I keep thinking about is all these House members went into a, like, classified briefing. Mm-hmm. And they came out. And in the Commerce, Energy and Commerce Committee, they voted 50-0 on this. Republicans and Democrats never agree on anything, and they all agreed on this. That said, if you're going to take away this platform for people for that 170 million Americans are using, you've got to make the case better than they have made the case.
Right.
And like, I realized that it, you know, probably some of the stuff was classified in a briefing, but whatever, you have to make some kind of presentation and convince the American people that this actually is a threat and why it's a threat. Is it the spying capabilities? Is it the propaganda capabilities? If so, what are they? Or at least you can talk in broad strokes about them. And if politicians can't do that, if the president can't do that, if Congress can't do that, then I don't think they should try to ban it.
Yeah, I agree with that. And I think that that really speaks to why people feel so upset about this, is that we hear these these kind of contradictory arguments that it's like it's a foreign policy decision because why would we allow this hostile authoritarian government to own a giant American media company or a giant media company that operates in America? And like, I think you're right. I think that's probably the actual motivation for the ban, but a lot of it gets couched in this like, oh, it's teen mental health, it's phone addiction. And it's like, if that were true, we all know that you would be regulating the American social media companies and you're not. So I think that not only do they have to make a case, and I agree with that, but I think they also need to stop trying to hang the case on things that we know are not the actual reason for it. Because if they were, again, we'd be regulating Meta.
Yeah. Well, I also think there's like First Amendment issues with American-based companies that aren't necessarily for foreign-based companies.
That's true.
Which is why we're not regulating them for a whole bunch of other reasons. But again, everyone knows the position of offline, ban all algorithms.
Yes, unironically.
Yeah. I mean, that's my position on this.
I think something I would love to see them do is like, let's pair this with saying we're actually going to try to pass federal data privacy laws. And let's put those two together and say this is all part of a package where we're trying to protect American consumers rather than saying we're trying to punish American consumers to make this like foreign policy based decision.
I think that's absolutely right on privacy. On the algorithms and the influence and all that kind of stuff, yeah. I think it's just it's a tough argument that I don't think a lot of our leaders have made.
Yeah.
Why these algorithmic social media apps are bad for you, right, aside from, like you said, teen mental health and stuff like that. But it's like, you know, we are in this fight for the survival of democracy. Mm-hmm. Stop sealing people in a cocoon of their own biases and interests.
Right. Yeah.
You know, like, because that's like antithetical to democracy, which requires empathy and curiosity and, you know, thoughtful debate in order to survive. Like that, there's a bigger issue here that I think if you're going to make an argument about democracy, that you should make that argument. And by the way, if our concern is that an authoritarian government is going to interfere in our elections or spread propaganda here, you can't go about banning it in an authoritarian-like way.
If
we want to defend democracy, we have to be democratic about it and have the argument, you know?
Yeah, I agree.
Anyway, that's my thing. All right, on to the biggest news of the millennium.
Oh, my goodness.
Okay, so we are recording this on Friday, March 15th, just in case anything happens. And Kate Middleton, the future Queen of England, hasn't been seen or heard from in public since Christmas, except for two grainy photos of her in cars and a March 10th Mother's Day photo.
Or are they photos of her?
Right. March 10th Mother's Day, first of all, one of the low-key weirder parts of this scandal is that I didn't know that Mother's Day was in March in the UK.
Yeah, they have their own Mother's Day. That's right. It's all part of the imperial decline.
Globalization? Why don't we all just pick a Mother's Day? Anyway. She hasn't been seen since. There's the two grainy photos and a March 10th Mother's Day photo of her and her children that she posted on Twitter, which she later admitted was photoshopped by her.
Well, she quote unquote she admitted.
Yeah, she admitted. Yeah, okay. She put up. She posted. Oh, there was a post from her.
The palace posted.
The palace posted.
Yeah,
but it said signed C from her. That she just like loves experimenting with photo editing and is sorry if anyone took offense. So people saw her in public on Christmas Day. Then on January 17th, Kensington Palace announced that the day before she had gone into the hospital for a pre-planned abdominal surgery.
Pre-planned, but no one had heard about this beforehand.
Right, pre-planned
just
to her.
So we're already getting some red flags, yeah.
And has been putting out periodic statements since then that she's home, recovering well, and will reappear on Easter, which is a good day for that kind of thing, traditionally.
Wow, did we just float a new Kate conspiracy that she is risen?
She is risen.
Good for her. I
was
love
like,
that.
Easter? Really? So, but that has not stopped the conspiracy theories, Max, which went from typical internet crazy to full-blown global hysteria after she posted an apology for photoshopping the Mother's Day picture, or an apology for photoshopping the Mother's Day picture was posted.
Right.
Allegedly by her.
Right.
All right. Have you brought me a whiteboard and some red string?
We're wheeling it in. We're going to need two or three whiteboards.
What is your take on this? When did you start following it? What do you think?
What is my take? So I became like ambiently aware even before the photo, capital T, capital P, came out on March 10th. People had been like kind of aware for a while that Kate Middleton was not showing up, that it was like weird that she hadn't been out there for a while. The surgery announcement was like throwing people off a little bit. I think there's a lot of people who just like as a hobby have fun tracking what's going on with the royal family. Mm-hmm. But I will say it did not really like crystallize for me how weird this was until the photo came out. Was clearly photoshopped.
Yeah.
The AP put out a like kill notice on the photo where they send out a memo to news agencies basically saying don't use this photo because it's faked, which is a big deal. And that was, and it was like, oh, this is actually like really strange. And the like statements that were coming out where they're refusing to elaborate on the abdominal surgery is strange. The fact that we haven't seen her except for this one grainy photo where she's faced away from the camera, which is like this photo was taken by Abraham Zapruder, apparently.
The first, there was another photo where she's in the car with her mom.
That's true.
Where you can see her. Well, she has very big sunglasses on, but yeah.
Yeah.
It does appear to be her.
It's all, so I think like a lot of this, of course, and I think we all know this on some level, a lot of this is probably just like the palace is being really ham-handed about how they manage the publicity around this. British tabloids like love to dig into every little detail. They've been diverting it very quickly to be like, oh, this is actually about like Prince William's mistress is pregnant, which is, to be clear, just a thing that they like speculating on and just making up as an explanation. Probably.
Rethink.
Right. Look, probably she's just sick. They actually, I didn't know this until I was looking at the research last night. They actually said when she went into surgery, she will be out of communication until March 31st.
Yeah.
So when you see that, it's like, oh, it's actually not as mysterious as I thought it was.
Right.
But I think, I really think that just what's going on here is it's just fun. It's a fun thing to like look at the photos that are like, anyone can participate. You zoom in on it. It's this kind of like big collective game that we all get to play about like speculating about what's going on. It's a goofy story. A
lot of fun jokes.
Yeah.
Really, right. Really good content from this. Mm-hmm. And that's what matters, right? But not Kate Middleton's privacy or health or well-being, but we need to have some good fun.
Well, I do think that that is part of it, is I think that we are all aware that this is someone who is going to be enormously wealthy and powerful for the rest of her life based on her job of waving to the camera occasionally. And like, look, I'm a professional podcaster, so like I have one of the all-time great bullshit jobs. I'm not like, I'm not giving her shit for it, but I think that it just feels very safe. It's not a controversial topic. It's one of the like last remaining topics we have that is not politically polarized. It's a reprieve from like everything that is terrifying about the news. So I do think it's just like a fun group activity that we get to have on our social media apps that are normally really upsetting and terrifying because it's about the war in Gaza, it's about the election that's coming up. And I think that it's like the fact that it is kind of news, but in a like for once fun way, and way that it's like emotionally a relief and enjoyable and feels socially bonding. I just think that's what's going on here. I don't think it's about lost trust in media. I don't think we're all becoming QAnon. Which is an argument a lot of people
make. No, yeah, there was Helen Lewis in The Atlantic wrote a piece that said, this is QAnon for wine moms.
Which is a great headline.
And look, I like wine. I'm not a mom. And in my For You feed on Twitter, all Kate content.
Are you pouring yourself a glass and scrolling to Kate Middleton?
Well, my wife, Emily, and a couple other our friends are on a text chain. They're very interested in it, and I have joined this text chain now a little belatedly.
Okay. As you guys like exchanging conspiracies.
Travis Helwig, favorite? Who was a crooked media staffer, he's on it too. I have no theory. Here's my thing on this. I am not one for conspiracy theories. Like, my first inclination is to always dismiss them because I think that people are either too fundamentally honest and decent or much more likely too stupid to pull them off. That is that is my overall take. I worked in the White House. I saw firsthand that scandals or mistakes that people attributed to nefarious motivations ended up being just people being
fuck-ups,
incompetence.
Right.
And I still think incompetence probably is the explanation behind this one.
Mm-hmm.
Because I cannot imagine something dumber than how the photo was handled from start to finish,
obviously,
which is why I am open to the more nefarious theory. Only because of that. Like, I just, the people who do, like, these are, I realize that the royal family is a very ancient institution, but the PR people around them, they do this for a living,
right?
And the tabloids in the UK are like, if maybe the only ones worse than here in the US especially around the royal family.
Yeah.
And so, like, these PR people around the prince and princess and king and queen, like, they weren't born yesterday.
Mm-hmm.
Like, why post the photo at all? Why post the photo at all? Why fake it? Why Photoshop it in such an obviously clumsy way?
Wait, are you saying you think they deliberately posted a photo that we would notice was altered to,
like, No, I don't think that. I'm just like, but no.
But that would be a fun conspiracy.
But why would you take that what are they doing? why did they need to post it? And then why did they follow up? Well, in the original photo, by the way, it says, like, taken by the Prince of Wales, right? So yeah, sure. William supposedly takes the picture.
Mm-hmm.
But then on the follow-up, they have Kate take the fall and say, oh, it was me photo editing? Why?
I think that is part of why this has become such a big story, is that because the handling of it has been so ham-fisted, it kind of invites all of us in to, like, let's look at the photo metadata. Like, let's look at the fact that her tweet doesn't make any sense, or that, like, the official timeline doesn't match up with, like, what they've been doing in terms of, like, canceling or postponing her events. That because of how many screw-ups the PR people have made, they've kind of laid out this game for us where we get to go through and, like, finding the inconsistencies and, like, piece together, like, what are the strands actually connect to?
Well, this is just me with my, like, you know, my PR press relations background hat on, but I'm like, I don't know that I've seen a move this stupid.
Do you know what it actually really reminds me of? Did you follow the, like, press tour controversy over this movie a year ago, Don't Worry, Darling?
Yes.
Okay. Where that it's like one of the stars, like, allegedly spit on one of the other stars, but they're like, people are not showing up to their events. It's like, clearly they just, like, all got in a big fight. And it was the PR for it was handled terribly, much like this. It was very ham-fisted, where we get these official explanations that are clearly not true. And that made it really fun to, like, dig into it and try to figure out what's happening.
And I also, I'm pretty close with someone who was heavily involved in that movie. And
was it Harry Styles?
It was not any of the stars. The person who wrote it. And so
I'm hearing Harry Styles.
And when they were all over there in Europe, mm-hmm. when all this was happening for the president, like, none of them knew exactly what the fallout, like, they didn't know the intent until they came back home.
Oh,
and then they
funny.
Saw the person, like, holy shit, what's been mm-hmm. happening over there? So there is a little bit of, like, I bring that up because, you know, perhaps the royal family mm-hmm. and certainly maybe even the PR people around the family are not quite as online as we all are. That's the only, right. But I find that hard to believe because it's their job.
I mean, the palace is a very old institution, and they are very accustomed to British media kind of deferring to them on a lot. So I think it is possible that they were just, like, not ready for this level of scrutiny.
Yeah.
Also, just people, like you say, people screw up sometimes. I will say something that, like, an argument I have seen a lot of people make that I do want to raise, because it's really dominant out there, is that this shows that, like, we are all becoming like QAnon in the sense that we no longer trust institutions and our sense of reality is fractured and we don't believe in anything anymore. And I think that gets what's happening exactly backwards. I actually think the lesson we should take from this is not that we are all becoming like QAnon, but I think rather what we should learn is that, like, things like QAnon are more driven by the sense of fun of pulling together a conspiracy than I think we appreciate. They're more driven by the fact that it's just bonding to, like, come together with your pals on the Discord or the Facebook group or whatever and, like, pull out a photo of Donald Trump and try to figure out what's going on in it. And I think we have underrated how much groups like QAnon that are very scary also, but are also just driven by the fact that, like, a lot of people are online and this is a way to feel like you have a sense of community and a sense of fun at a time when the news is very scary.
I think that's an excellent point. And it's also, like, the issue of trust.
Sure.
You know, low trust, loss of trust is sort of like the defining characteristic of this era.
It is, yeah.
But we've known that for a while.
Right.
And sort of like, you know, a loss of faith in institutions. It started that way. It's sort of like trickled down to each other. Mm-hmm. And I almost think that one response, this is like a response to that.
Yeah.
And that, like, well, we're all going to form a community. We obviously know that they're lying to us. But we can't trust, whether they're lying or not, we can't trust them to tell the truth.
Right.
But now we're going to form this community and try to figure out our own truth.
Right.
Which can go, you know, as we've seen with QAnon and places like that, quite badly.
Yeah.
Or it can be harmless fun.
I think that's true. And I think think it's also important to know that, like, the psychological research into conspiracy belief, something that they really emphasize is that the point of these kind of, like, conspiracy parsing groups or collective efforts is not necessarily to try to arrive at an explanation, but because the act itself of, like, sharing and discussing a conspiracy in, like, your group chat, that in and of itself gives you a sense of control and ownership over what's happening. It gives you a sense of, like, I'm participating in this. I'm figuring out what's going on. That makes me feel more stable, like more control over what's happening in the world, especially at a time when, like, the news is very scary and we feel out of control.
Yeah.
And so I think it's important to think of it as, like, the act of, like all the Taylor Swift stuff, like parsing out, like, where is she going when she's, like, I think less the point of that is to actually arrive at a conclusion of, like, what's the secret message that she's trying to send us, and more just the fact that doing that with all your fellow Swifties online makes you feel like you have a sense of community and makes you feel like you have a handle on what's going on in the world.
I think this is going to end with Kate Middleton reappearing with a well-known London boy, Joe Alwyn, Taylor Swift ex, and that's really going to connect it all. I will just one the whole thing about, like, I've seen a lot of takes about, you know, the this is QAnon for wine moms and everyone's lost their mind with the conspiracy theories. Again, I lay the blame for this on the palace because of the picture.
Absolutely.
It's one thing to be like, you know, the poor girl had surgery, and, like, she said, I'm going to need time to recuperate. You won't hear from me. Like, just leave her alone. Totally get that. The picture and the handling of the picture. Like, I'm just a humble podcaster. Probably have less than 1% name ID in this country. If I suddenly disappeared around Christmas for a surgery and Cricket just put out a statement, and then none of you guys talked about it in any of the shows,
it would be weird.
And I was like, I'll be back on March 31st, and then suddenly I just posted a picture of me and Teddy and Charlie that was just completely fake.
That's true. It would invite some questions.
Right.
Especially
from a small group of people, but yeah, it would invite some questions.
Especially if people kept asking us, like, hey, what's going on with John?
Right.
And we just straight up refused to say. Refused to tell anyone, and we were also like, it's abdominal, but you can't see his face. People would be like, that's fucking weird. That's suspect.
And I just put up a picture of myself with, like, 7 fingers.
Like, and also the royal children.
Anyway, it's wild. I can't wait to hear what happens. All right. Some quick housekeeping before the break. There's no need to sit in your house freaking out about November. We've reserved a whole theater for that. If you're in Brooklyn, Boston, Madison, Phoenix, Philly, or Ann Arbor, we're bringing our sweet, sweet content directly to you when Pod Save America goes on our Democracy or Else tour this summer.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, right? And we're not coming empty-handed. There's a VIP ticket bundle that includes a signed copy of our new book, Democracy or Else, How to Save Democracy in 10 Easy Steps, for book lovers and tyranny haters alike. See all the tour dates and get your tickets now at crooked.com/events. And you may have heard that Vote Save America launched a little something called the Anxiety Relief Program. So we've been donating the money to some groups in swing states that are helping to mobilize voters. There's a group in Ohio called the Organizing Collaborative. They're trying to register 250,000 new voters. So we gave some money to them. And there's a group called Power to the Polls in Milwaukee. They're trying to engage 50,000 voters. So we helped with that goal as well. And also groups in North Carolina, in Montana, all over the country, all over these in places where there are big Senate races, down ballot races, local races. So VSA needs your help to keep supporting grassroots groups like these. And if you're eager to make a difference and get involved, set up a recurring monthly donation at VoteSaveAmerica.com today. Paid for by Vote Save America, VoteSaveAmerica.com. Not authorized by any candidate or candidate's committee. After the break, Max talks to Dylan Matthews about a New York Times UFO series that convinced the internet aliens were among us. Offline is brought to you by ZBiotics. After a night with drinks, it can be hard to bounce back the next day. You probably have to make a choice. You can either have a great night or a great next day. Well, now there's ZBiotics.
You don't have to choose.
No choice necessary. ZBiotics pre-alcohol probiotic drink is the world's first genetically engineered probiotic. It was invented by PhD scientists to tackle rough mornings after drinking. Here's how it works. When you drink, alcohol gets converted into a toxic byproduct in the gut. It's this byproduct, not dehydration, that's to blame for your rough next day. ZBiotics produces an enzyme to break this byproduct down. Just remember to make ZBiotics your first drink of the night. Drink responsibly, and you'll feel your best tomorrow. The toughest thing is when you have a drink and then like you're halfway through the drink and you're like, oh shit, I forgot take my Z-Biotics. And then I just take it. And then you take like two or three to double up. No, you don't do that. It works. I've said it a million times. It is one of the great inventions of the modern age.
Wow.
Is Z-Biotics. Wow. Just telling you. Just try it. Try it. And
Guys, try a Vision Pro yet.
I promise you, you'll enjoy it. Go to zbiotics.com/offline to get 15% off your first order when you use offline at checkout. Zbiotics is backed with 100% money back guarantee. So if you're unsatisfied for any reason, they'll refund your money, no questions asked. That's zbiotics.com/offline. Thank you, Zbiotics, for sponsoring this episode and our good times.
Hey everyone, it's Ted from Consumer Cellular, the guy in the orange sweater, and this is your wake-up call. If you're paying too much for wireless service, you don't have to keep having that nightmare. Consumer Cellular has the same fast, reliable coverage as the leading carriers for less. And for a limited time, new customers receive their second month free when they sign up and use promo code MONTHFREE by May 31st. So why keep spending more than you have to? Seriously, wake up and call 1-888-FREEDOM or visit ConsumerCellular.com.
Taxes, fees, and other third-party charges will apply. See website for additional details.
Whether you're a morning person or a bedtime procrastinator, everyone deserves a mattress that works for their style. And you'll find the best mattress for you at Ashley. The new Tempur-Adapt collection at Ashley brings you one-of-a-kind body-conforming technology, making every sleep tailored to be your best. The collection also features cool-to-the-touch covers and motion absorption to help minimize sleep disruptions from partners, pets, or kids. Shop the all-new Tempur-Adapt collection at Ashley in-store or online at ashley.com. Ashley. For the love of home.
Dylan Matthews, welcome to Offline.
Thank you for having me, Max Fisher.
Great to be chatting with my old pal. So, Dylan, you wrote in 2021 a big piece that I still send to people all the time, anytime they tell me that the UFOs are real. And your piece kind of traced the very strange circumstances and personalities that had led to the mainstreaming of the idea that UFOs are here, announced, of course, via several big New York Times stories. And I wanted to get into it because it feels like as of this week, the fever is maybe breaking. Like this long-awaited Pentagon study came out, produced as a result of all of those UFO stories, that concluded, quote, all investigative efforts at all levels of classification concluded that most sightings were ordinary objects and phenomenon and the result of misidentification, and it said there were no aliens.
It's very sad, but we have to live with the reality we have.
So I want to talk about how we ended up with this story instead. Go through the timeline from fringe conspiracy to mainstream New York Times. But before we get to that, can you just explain the like three videos that kind of become at the center of all this? Like, what are the videos? What do they show? Who recorded them?
Sure. So I believe they're all Navy videos from naval aviators. And these were the sort of focus of the December 2017 New York Times story that sort of mainstreamed this story, at least in the current era. And they were all cases where naval aviators saw kind of odd things, either on their radars or their cameras. So there's one that's sometimes called the Tic Tac incident that was off the coast of San Diego, about 100 miles. These two pilots, David Fravor and Amy Dietrich, saw this object that Fravor described as kind of turning abruptly and mimicking me and then simply disappearing. And then he claims that a few seconds later, another flight crew reacquired the target. And this was about
like 60 miles away. Right?
Yeah. So this is where you get some of the claims about them having sort of superhuman speed, having abilities that we don't know of American or Chinese or Russian. So this video is called the FLIR 1 video. It's the one that this other team took based on the Fravor and Dietrich testimony.
Which is named for FLIR, the like infrared camera they have on all these Navy fighter jets.
Exactly. And the second one, Gimbal, is similarly named after sort of the Gimbal camera. That was a fighter jet off of Florida. And you can listen to it. It's funny to just like watch naval fighter pilots talk to each other. It's different from Top Gun, but not as much as you might think.
Yes, it's so funny hearing these videos. They do not talk in the way you think. There's one of them is at one point is like, bro, we're surrounded by drones.
And then you think about it and you're like, yeah, these are like 25-year-olds.
Right, yes.
Yeah, like, of course they talk like this.
Flying billion-dollar airplanes, yeah.
Yeah, but one of the pilots says he sees a whole fleet of these. Mm-hmm. And then there was a third one, which was recorded also in 2015. So both Gimbal and Go Faster 2015 videos. That one shows a sort of small white object that's going over water, and it appears to be going over the water very, very rapidly. And you can hear the pilots getting very, very excited about this. so these were first written about in December 2017. In March 2018, so a few months later, the Pentagon officially released them, declassified them. The guy who I think is the crucial source for the New York Times and those stories is a guy named Christopher Mellon. And once you start following the sources from Christopher Mellon, you get into a whole interesting web of people very interested in aliens and sort of motivated by a very strong desire to believe.
Well, that's actually exactly what I want to talk about, because the videos, of course, are real in that they really recorded these incidents. And then people saw the New York Times stories reporting on these videos several years later. But I think what is really fascinating here in the story that you tell is about Christopher Mellon and these like four other personalities who kind of convene around these videos. This very like odd group. Honestly, it would make for an amazing like Hulu miniseries, because these four or five very strong personalities come together and they are the people who take these videos and then construct around them, or not, they wouldn't say construct, they would say kind of help inform the rest of the world about their reading the videos, which is it shows, you know, the existence of flying saucers over American coastline. So we start with Christopher Mellon. He's our first big personality. Who is he? Where does he come from? How does he get into UFOs?
So Christopher Mellon is first of all, he's a Mellon. So anyone who's gone to Carnegie Mellon or who knows about the banker Andrew Mellon, who was later Secretary of Treasury and kind of caused the Great Depression.
he's an accomplished man.
He was an accomplished man. But Chris Mellon was sort of a career intelligence guy. He had been Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense for Intel under Clinton and George W. Bush.
Serious guy.
Long tenure as a civilian in the intelligence community. He gets very interested in UFOs. And he has said that he has a longstanding interest in this, but that the guy who sort of made him turn pro once he retired from government was a guy named Tom DeLonge.
Yes, and that what I think the most fascinating personality in this whole story.
This is America in one book. So Tom DeLonge, fellow children of the late 90s will remember, is the guitarist for Blink 182.
And it's a truly trash band.
Look, I have my disagreements with the man. Let's not say things about all the small things and what's
You're
my
right.
age again that we can't take back.
You're he right. wrote Let's some hold bops. To the substance.
he and Mark Hoppus and Travis Barker were like a really impressive trio in their heyday. I have all their albums. Look, I'm trying to build connections here. Tom DeLonge is very interested in aliens. And he had started this group called To the Stars Academy. Mm-hmm. It almost started to feel like a think tank in that it was a waiting area for ex-government people with an interest in a given topic. And so if you're interested in counterinsurgency, you go to the Center for New American Security. If you're into aliens, you go to the Stars Academy. and so Christopher Mellon goes to the Stars Academy and gets
captured. Recruited, right? Like Tom DeLonge calls him.
Tom DeLonge called me out of the blue one day, Mellon says.
Okay, so Tom DeLonge is like the great convener. He pulls in Christopher Mellon to his group, and he also pulls in this guy, Luis Elizondo, who is very important to this story. Can you tell us about him?
Yes. So Elizondo is also our connection point to some of the early history of these investigations. So Elizondo, like Mellon, is a former civil servant. He's a former counterintelligence officer by background, and he gets into this around 2010, and he takes over this this program that's called the Advanced Aerospace Threat Identification Program. And so this is a group at DOD that's tasked with investigating these videos. And sort of any time that a aviator, spy camera, whatever, sees an object that seems strange and not easily explained, it goes to this team. And you might be wondering, why does the DOD have a team like this? And I mean, on the one hand, it's not an unreasonable thing for them to have. Like, sure. As we saw with the Chinese spy incident with the balloon last year, there is weird stuff happening in the skies. And it's the DoD's job to figure out what it is. And so that was part of their job. But also, Harry Reid, who at this point was Senate Majority Leader and Senator from Nevada, he had a longstanding interest in UFOs himself. He also had a relationship with a guy named Robert Bigelow, who was a Nevada businessman.
Very important to this story.
Very important in the story. So Robert Bigelow is in some ways kind of patient zero of this whole phenomenon.
Where did he get his money again? It's like hotels, right?
Extended stay hotels. He became rich from Budget Suites of America. I think we're now familiar with the idea that if you get rich from some means, eventually you will want to build rockets.
You kind of invents this, but he's not building rockets, right? He wants to track the rockets because they're being flown by little green men.
He has dreams of building the rockets. He wants to build he wants to be the SpaceX of space stations. He wants to build his own commercial space station himself. This has not gone anywhere, but they've launched a couple experimental things. He also always been interested in the paranormal. Mm-hmm. So in 1995, he starts this thing called the National Institute for Discovery Science that's interested in things like UFOs. It's also interested in cattle mutilation, which is a sort of connected to UFOs, but a common kind of like spooky occurrence in the country, sort of like crop circles or other sort of strange phenomena that feels vaguely linked to the paranormal. And as part of these studies, he also bought this cattle ranch in Utah called Skinwalker Ranch and rigged it with all kinds of cameras. Anyway, so Robert Bigelow, into all this kind of stuff, has a lot of money, has a relationship with Harry Reid. Harry Reid, I think, was initially receptive to this himself. Like, I don't want to make it seem like he's a UFO guy. Harry Reid gets a bunch of money in what's called the black budget, which is the classified part of the intelligence budget where the details aren't made public. It gets about $22 million to set up a section at the DOD. And so that's the section where Luis Elizondo, this career civil servant, starts studying these videos and starts becoming convinced that something out of the ordinary is happening in them.
So just to pull these connections together, Robert Bigelow, the Skinwalker Ranch guy, the extended stay hotels guy, is a donor to Harry Reid, and he wants Harry Reid to set up funding to study UFOs. Harry Reid sets up this $22 million program. My understanding, most of that money actually goes back to Bigelow. He actually ends up recouping a lot of that in terms of like contracts to like run it out of his ranch. And this is the Advanced Aerospace Threat Identification Program that is funded thanks to Harry Reid and weirdo rich guy Robert Bigelow that employs Luis Elizondo to look at videos like the ones that you mentioned. Luis Elizondo does look at the videos, but he feels his work isn't being taken seriously, which is how when he leaves his job, and I think it's early 2017, he ends up with Tom DeLonge, the Blink-182 guy, who is running this To the Stars think tank for identifying the little green men. Does I have all that right so far?
That is all right so far. And I think him joining To the Stars, the Tom DeLonge group, where he's working alongside Christopher Mellon, is I think a key pivotal point in sort of the cultural shift we've seen over the last 10 years. They help make the New York Times story possible and publicize these videos that have now become so famous. There's sort of a funny story that Mellon tells about how they got the videos to the New York Times. So he claims that he met somebody in a parking lot who was a source of his from the Pentagon. That they had like this real like all the president's men deep throat thing where they met in a parking lot, passed the videos off, and along with documentation showing it was approved for public release and unclassified. Mellon has never told me, has to my knowledge never told another journalist sort of who the source was. That was the point at which he and To the Stars got the videos, and from him, mm-hmm. the New York Times got the videos for their story.
Yes. So let's tell the story of how that. So they have the videos, and they have Luis Elizondo, who worked inside this like black budget program connected somehow to the Bigelow Ranch. So they have this story. They want to get this out to the world, and they get Leslie Kane to help them do it. Can you, because you've talked to her, can you tell us about who she is, what her beliefs are?
So Kane is, like Mellon, she's kind of an East Coast Brahmin. She's the niece of Thomas Kane, who was governor of New Jersey and was the chair of the 9/11 commission.
Wow.
Olds like us will remember him. His son, Thomas Kane Jr., Leslie Kane's cousin, is currently a congressman.
Really? Wow. So she's very connected.
Very, very connected. And she's been interested in UFOs for years. I would describe her as sort of a long-form nonfiction, sort of book nonfiction writer. And she wrote a book in 2010 that was sort of a compilation of firsthand UFO experiences. And I think already there, she was showing off some political connections. One of her, the foreword for the book was written by John Podesta. who was chief of staff of the White House.
Also kind of a UFO guy, right?
Very much a UFO guy. One thing I learned saying this is that people who you would think would have been informed about the UFOs.
Yeah, somehow, it's weird that he would have to be a conspiracy theorist. Like, can't he just walk down the hall and ask someone,
like,
are
they
the
would
UFOs
have
real?
Told him. I mean, in the X-Files, they hide some things even from the president.
Sure. And this is kind of the wavelength that Leslie Kane is operating of. And To the Stars pulls her in to help publicize what they believe is evidence of UFOs, because she's a true believer herself. And she's been writing stuff like a few months before that. She had like a Huffington Post story about the Chilean Navy saw something that she thinks is a UFO, which is still not someone you would expect to get you on the front page of the New York Times. And that brings us to the last big personality who does land that for them and does like get them on the front page of the Times, who's Ralph Blumenthal. Can you tell us about him?
So Ralph Blumenthal was a lifer at the New York Times. He worked there for 45 years, which, you worked there for what, like six or seven?
And seven, and that's plenty.
Yeah.
God bless.
God bless, Ralph for making it longer. But he retired in 2009. And knew Leslie Kane, and I think most relevantly for these purposes, Blumenthal has also long been interested in extraworldly phenomena. He wrote a biography of a guy named John Mack. He's a Pulitzer Prize winning
abduction guy, right?
Yes, and. He was the chair of the Department of Psychiatry at Harvard Med School for decades and was sort of seen as a teen suicide and drug use expert. Very, very respected guy who, toward the end of his career, started interviewing people who claimed that they had been abducted by aliens and became deeply convinced that they had been abducted by aliens.
And Blumenthal kind of believes this too, right? Or he believes that John Mack was onto something.
Exactly. There's sort of like a Russian nesting doll of claims when it comes to like UFOs and aliens.
Right.
And like on the very outer layer, there's the universe is massive. Somewhere out there in the universe, there's another intelligent life form. Like that seems totally reasonable to believe. Maybe we haven't encountered it yet, but like I don't think that's crazy at all. Somewhere in there, there's craft from another civilization has reached us and observed us. I haven't been convinced by the evidence, but that's one thing. You know, we send craft out into the universe all the time. People might have encountered Voyager or Pioneer or whatever. Aliens have come close enough to Earth to get humans, take them into a craft, and then put them back again. Is, I think, like orders of magnitude more outlandish than they have just visited us.
Well, okay. So I think this is important because I'm not trying to like drag Leslie Kane and Ralph Blumenthal through the mud or anything. I think what's important to understand is these are the two people who pitch the New York Times, who write the story. They are recruited to do that, to package this story for the Times by To the Stars, not because they're writers and reporters, although they are, but also because they are themselves true believers. And they think that it's really important to get the word out as that, like, this paranormal X-Files stuff is true. And they see their role less as dispassionately reporting on, like, what does Luis Elizondo say happened at this program he worked on? What do these videos show? And maybe more bringing awareness to what they have always believed is the truth, which is that aliens are arriving at Earth. So I think that's important to, like, understand for how we now get, they get to the point of writing this big story in 2017 for the Times. Can you talk about how they landed that story?
Yeah, I mean, and Blumenthal said basically what you're saying, that I asked him sort of, why didn't you include the stuff about alien abductions if you sort of were persuaded by this? And he said, you know, it's much easier to interest people in the Times about something about UFOs than about alien encounters. Alien encounters seem too weird for them. So he was sort of making an Overton window
argument.
So it's
kind of strategic.
Yeah, you have to start with the thing that seems a little plausible, and then sort of once people are starting to accept the alien mindset, you can work them up to abductions. But the process was that Chris Mellon and To the Stars offered Leslie Kane the UFO videos on the condition that she was able to place the story in the New York Times. They didn't want her just going to Huffington Post or somewhere writing on her personal blog or something. They wanted the imprimatur of like a serious news organization to sort of give this credibility as a real story. And so that's when Blumenthal got involved, and Blumenthal took the story directly to Dean Baquet, who at that point was the top editor at the Times. A co-author on many of their initial stories on this is Helene Cooper, who is a very well-respected sort of foreign correspondent. The sense I get is that that was mostly Blumenthal had already retired. Leslie Kane was not a New York Times reporter. Cooper was kind of like their chaperone, like putting someone who was a current staffer on with a byline as a way of sort of integrating these people who are outside of the normal apparatus.
We should say that's really unusual. It's unusual to have two outsiders who are not at the paper writing a front page investigative story. It's unusual that one of them is kind of a little bit of an activist. It's unusual that they pitched it directly to the executive editor of the paper. And it's unusual that they went from pitch to the front page in only 2 months. Like having run a lot of stories through that bureaucracy, that's very fast. And I think that's like maybe context for how this all landed on the front page when in other circumstances, maybe it wouldn't have.
Yeah. And I think one of the things that staggered me, I've never worked at the Times. And so I anything I know about their internal processes is secondhand at best, but they do strike me as an organization that moves slow on some things and that tries to wait until they have something dead to rights. In 2020 there was the big story on Trump's taxes, for which they got sort of leaked tax returns and private financial information from Trump's niece, and
they spent years on it.
Years and years to make sure that they had that dead to rights, as they should. And when it came to some of the claims, not just in 2017, but in some of the follow-up stories, the claim that off-world vehicles had reached Earth strikes me as much harder to believe than that Donald Trump cheated on his taxes.
and yet receives much less scrutiny.
Yeah. Right. Does not seem to have received the same level of fact-checking.
This episode of Offline is supported by How to Fix the Internet, an original podcast from the Electronic Frontier Foundation. Sometimes it can feel like we're lurching towards a digital future no one wants, but it doesn't have to be that way. There are choices we can make to create an internet that makes a better future for all of us. Technologists and policymakers have real solutions to the problems facing our online world today. Surveillance capitalism, AI and machine learning, and digital privacy. We can build an internet that has all of the good things we want from tech with none of the creepy stuff. The hosts are Cindy Cohen and Jason Kelly. Cindy is the executive director of the Electronic Frontier Foundation and has been in the trenches, the courtrooms, and boardroom of tech activism for decades. Jason is EFF's activism director, focusing his work on privacy, free speech, and surveillance. In each episode, Cindy and Jason invite someone with a vision on how to fix the internet, someone with real solutions on how to move the needle towards a better online world. This show will make you feel better about our digital future, be more knowledgeable about what needs fixing, and be more engaged to demand change. I just listened to the second episode of the new season. It's called Open Source Beats Authoritarianism, and it is a fantastic interview with Audrey Tang. She was the Taiwan's first digital minister, which is really cool, and she has done a lot with open source to sort of show how openness is sort of the best antidote to authoritarianism and more transparency in government. It's an excellent episode. Really cool series. If you like offline, you will love this. So search for How to Fix the Internet in your podcast player. My thanks to How to Fix the Internet for their support. Episodes are available anywhere you listen to podcasts and at EFF.org/podcast.
Hey, everyone. It's Ted from Consumer Cellular, the guy in the orange sweater, and this is your wake-up call. If you're paying too much for wireless service, you don't have to keep having that nightmare. Consumer Cellular has the same fast, reliable coverage as the leading carriers for up to half the cost. So why keep spending more than you have to? Seriously, wake up and call 1-888-FREEDOM or visit ConsumerCellular.com.
Savings based on cost of Consumer Cellular single line 1, 5, and 10 gig data plans with unlimited talk and text compared to lowest cost single line postpaid unlimited talk, text, and data plans offered by T-Mobile and Verizon January 2024.
The living room is where you make life's most beautiful memories. But your sofa shouldn't be the one remembering them. The new life-resistant, high-performance furniture collection from Ashley is designed to withstand all the spills, slip-ups, and muddy paws that come with the best parts of life. Ashley high-performance sofas and recliners are soft, on-trend, and easy to clean. Shop the high-performance furniture in-store or online at ashley.com. Ashley, for the love of home.
So the story comes out and it describes these three videos, which again are real. They're real videos,
yes,
that show something happening. We're not sure what. They talk a lot to Luis Elizondo, who wrote at this advanced threat detection thing at the Pentagon and about his program. It also goes a little bit beyond that and talks a lot about like Robert Bigelow's the weird billionaire who was giving money to Harry Reid, stuff that's going on at his ranch. It talks about materials recovered from UFOs, but it's all secondhand. And that my memory of the way that story was received, even though the story doesn't say this, but would people receive that story as UFOs are here, the Pentagon has known about it for years, it's now been leaked by people who left the Pentagon, and, you know, even if it's not aliens, it's definitely something that seems beyond what we think humans are capable of, and there's a lot of smoke here. Do you think that's right? That's like, is that,
yes,
how you remember,
I think,
being
that
received?
That is very much the impression. And I think, like, one of the more important claims that I saw in there was claims that one of Robert Bigelow's facilities was modified so it could house, and I'm quoting here, metal alloys and other materials that Mr. Elizondo and program contractors said had been recovered from unidentified aerial phenomena. And Blumenthal on MSNBC promoting the story said, mm-hmm, researchers couldn't tell you what these metal alloys were. It was not a metal alloy that humans on Earth were familiar with. And I think that was one of the first points where I was reading this, and I think where a lot of people read it, where our sort of eyebrows perked up, and a bunch of chemists started to chime in and say, you know, figuring out what alloy something is one of the things that chemists are really, really good at. Like, there's a lot of things that they still struggle with, but they have, like, defined techniques to sort through metal alloys. And the idea that, like, someone at the Pentagon would not be able to do this for something, mm-hmm, that's a strong claim.
So Congress starts taking this pretty seriously. Can you talk about some of the things they do in response to these stories?
The investigations really pick up after 2017, mm-hmm, and, mm-hmm, the New York Times stories. So there's something called the Unidentified Aerial Phenomena Task Force, which released a sort of preliminary report on this in 2021, which was what sort of my piece back then was pegged to. I think sort of spurred a lot of coverage in a lot of quarters on this idea, mm-hmm, because it was sort of a very public examination of this by a Pentagon that has been very, right. But it didn't end there. There's also the Airborne Object Identification and Management Synchronization Group, the UAP Independent Study Team, and as you said, sort of a number mm-hmm. of congressional hearings about this, where people like right. Elizondo and Mellon are called to Congress to testify and talk about what they know. And I think part of what was interesting about that was there's a very different sort of tactical approach taken by the Pentagon, that it wasn't, we're going to just call these guys crazy. And I think some of that is a sort of a strategic decision of, people have questions about this, we shouldn't mock them for having questions about this. We should try to be open about it. But also, sort of, this was a time when we were getting more hawkish towards both China and Russia. And I think many of the most plausible explanations I've seen for what these things are is that they might be things like the Chinese weather balloon we saw last year. Weather balloons obviously can't move super fast or do some of the things we saw in these videos. But there's just a long history of people getting recordings of aircraft that look super weird that later turns out to be sort of a secretive military project. And that I think is something that Congress was more willing to hear in the context where they're really sort of eager to have a, or I wouldn't say eager, but except that we have an adversarial relationship with right. Russia and China.
Well, and there's kind of a great irony to all this, that as a result of that 2017 New York Times story playing up this now defunct and like kind of fake UFO tracking program that Harry Reid had funded and Luis Elizondo had worked for, that like as a result of that story, Congress then goes on to push through actually real Pentagon programs to examine the evidence around UFO videos. So it's this kind of like self-fulfilling, like it goes from fake to real as a result of reporting on the fake thing as if it was real.
It's such a great story about like the fractal complexity of essentially yeah. Pentagon bureaucracy.
It is a bureaucracy story in a lot of ways.
Yeah. I had some conversation with Christopher Mellon where I asked sort of, couldn't this be even like a U.S. sort of secretive vehicle? His line was, I would have known if we had a craft like this. Like, I was high up enough that I would have known mm-hmm. all of the different sort of experimental aircraft. And like, maybe. But I think one of my takeaways from this story is there is no one in the Pentagon who knows everything the Pentagon is doing.
That's true. Although we should say that a lot of these subsequent government-mandated investigations into the videos concluded that it was probably just, or that some of them were probably just like visual artifacts
yes.
from things that were happening, or if it was like just a commercial plane taking off that produced something that looked weird on an infrared camera. But I want to get back to the kind of narrative of how this is unfolding. So summer 2020, which is just when a lot of these big government investigations are happening and Congress is getting really involved, Leslie Kane and Ralph Blumenthal do their second big story for the New York Times. And for me, this is when it felt like the wheels were kind of starting to come off on this campaign. Can you talk about what happened there and why that story started to create some weirdness around all this?
Yes. So the 2020 story is interesting in a lot of ways. One is that sort of the training wheels are off, that yeah, it's right. Blumenthal and Kane. Helene Cooper is no longer involved. They're writing this on their own. Sort of the key focus of the story was that there was this investigation looking into these things and that soon it was going to release a public report on UFO mm-hmm. activity. It has a bunch of quotes from Marco Rubio, who was really urging sort of more disclosure about this. But the piece is also sort of talks to Harry Reid about his longstanding interest, talks to Luis Elizondo. And then buried in it are some pretty extreme claims that this is where sort of the wheels come in that I think went well beyond anything that the Times had reported before. So they quote mm-hmm. A guy named Eric W. Davis, who we say a little more about in a minute, but who was a consultant on the UFO program that Elizondo worked on. And it quotes him as saying that the examination of the materials had not determined their source, and he concluded that that we couldn't make the materials we got ourselves. And he further claimed that he had gotten a classified briefing as recently as March, about retrievals from off-world vehicles not made on this Earth.
So the story is kind of suggesting that the Pentagon has alien UFOs that it's recovered, but it turns out the basis of this is a contractor who's kind of a weirdo who says he went to a meeting once where someone told him this. But this is present, again, a lot of people who are reading the newspaper and right. who believe what it says thinks, wow, the New York Times is telling me that the Pentagon has alien UFOs now.
If you read about like weird stuff the Pentagon has funded, Eric Davis will come up in stories you find about that.
Yeah.
His sort of raison d'etre seems to be starting companies that get consulting jobs to look into mm-hmm. sort of strange phenomena. He got a $7.5 million grant from the Air Force to study what he called psychic teleportation, or the ability to transport
wow.
yourself across the Earth with the power of your mind. And I definitely understand why that would be militarily relevant.
Doesn't mean it's real. Or that we need to make this guy our source in the New York Times for saying the UFOs are here.
And when I talked to Blumenthal about this, he said, you know, we didn't say that we verified it. We just said that he said it. And I don't know, like, you know what you're doing when you include a line like that. And
sure.
we have UFOs in a storage locker is like one of the greatest buried leads of all time.
So, okay. So I think at this point, if you were just like a regular casual news consumer, your experience of this story is the New York Times has now confirmed multiple times in a row that the UFOs are here and that the Pentagon thinks they're probably little green men who are just like hanging out on the Southern California coast. But I think if you are like you or me and a like close follower of weird media stuff, or, like, know how to read between the lines of what happens
sure.
in coverage, you start to see a lot of indications that the major media institutions have lost faith in this story. Leslie Kane and Ralph Blumenthal only ever have one additional byline in the New York Times, and it's just like an update on a congressional hearing.
Right.
All of the hearings and the like reports, the government reports that start coming out, all keep saying one after another, it's like, no, here's all the evidence. These are just weird visual artifacts in these videos, and it's probably not UFOs. But then I think the big nail in this story comes like a year ago when Leslie Kane and Ralph Blumenthal have their third big story on this, but it runs in this website called The Debrief. Had you mm-hmm. ever heard of this website before?
It was new to me.
Yeah. So can you talk about like what the story says and what we should read, or what you, I should say, read into the fact that it appeared in The Debrief and not, say, in The New York Times?
So at this point, the Times pieces by Blumenthal and Kane have been getting progressively more extreme in what they're claiming. It's not just mm-hmm. this unit at the Pentagon has seen some strange things. It's we have off-world vehicles. We have metal alloys that that no one understands. And where it really takes off is this story for The Debrief. And I think it's telling, as you say, that the Times didn't snap it up. So the heart of the piece is a guy named David Grush, who was a military veteran, fought in mm-hmm. Afghanistan, worked for a couple of reconnaissance agencies, and was lead on sort of analysis of UAPs for something called the National Geospatial Intelligence Agency, which my understanding is that they do a lot of sort of satellite espionage
right.
stuff.
Sure. Yeah. Look at satellite photos, tell you what they say.
Right. And worked on the UAP task force, which wrote the sort of preliminary 2021 report that was fairly dismissive of the evidence here. And Grush in this piece tells Blumenthal and Kane that sort of the task force was basically doing a cover up, that they didn't include everything that they knew, including he said there were fragments of exotic origin reflecting a non-human
Whoa.
Intelligence that he had learned about as part of his service on the task force, and that this was not mentioned at all in the UAP task force report. And so this fits very well in sort of the narrative that they want to tell of sort of brave truth tellers in the military being silenced by the powers that be, that the UIP task force was not the government opening up. It was them sort of silencing people who wanted to vouch for the real evidence that of aliens, and sort of making a hero of this guy Grush. And I think there were a lot of things about Grush's testimony that raised red flags. Specifically the idea that there are these specific materials recovered from other civilizations mm-hmm. that were being stored somewhere. Like that's a big claim, and also like seems like it should be provable. Like you should be able to produce those materials. And I think it got even more dramatic when he testified before Congress and he claimed that not only has material from these UFOs been recovered, but life forms, biological life forms, have been recovered. And people can watch this hearing online. Maybe you buy them, maybe you don't. I think what's striking about the hearing is that every time a member of Congress asked him to elaborate on this, he kind of deflected. He admitted he had never mm-hmm. seen these vehicles or bodies. He said it was just based on witnesses that he had interviewed. And would his go-to response when people asked sort of follow-up questions was, I can only tell you this in a SCIF. A SCIF is a sensitive compartmented information facility, which are where some super high security debriefings and things happen in the intelligence community. And so I think I got the impression from that hearing that this is a guy who's making some really wild claims, when pressed on them, hides behind
lack of evidence. Yeah.
Confidentiality. So I did not personally move my views on this very much in response to him. But I think you're right that as a media story, the fact that he could only get this sort of obscure website to care about it, and that Kane and Blumenthal weren't able to place anything in the New York Times where they had been writing, was maybe reflective that some higher-ups and sort of the media industry generally is starting to look at this more skeptically.
Well, and Vanity Fair reported, too, that Leslie Cade, Ralph Blumenthal had tried to get this in the New York Times. The New York Times said no. They took it to the Washington Post. The Washington Post spent weeks on it trying to confirm any of the information on it. They passed. They took it to Politico, and Politico passed. And I think what is really striking to me, kind of looking back over the like whole arc of the story and how it rose and fell, is that everything that was weird about that story that last year that nobody wanted to run and ended up having to run on this obscure kind of fringy website, the Debrief, was also true to some extent of their first stories. Like all the stories in the New York Times, like a lot of it rested on like one weird guy who was in the government. A lot of it rested on like second or third hand claims. And I think something that I'm really left with, and I'm really curious for your thoughts on, is why did it take us 6 years to kind of come around to finally being skeptical about something that we should have been skeptical about from the beginning? Was it that we wanted to believe it? Were we just like eager to buy into this despite the evidence? Like, what do you think happened there?
So I think one piece of context for 2017 is so much of the news was so bleak that it wasn't just that Trump was president, but that was the fall of Weinstein, that Jody Kantor and Megan Twohy did their big report that fall. The first initial wave of Me Too, Charlie Rose, Kevin Spacey, Louis C.K., mm-hmm. on and on. And so sort of the news cycle was being dominated by a president who was completely out of control and seemed eager to start a nuclear war, and sort of collapse of a, I don't know if collapse is strong, but sort of a key sort of misogynistic assumptions in our society being like very weakened, and a real like cultural rupture happening on that. And I think a lot of the reaction I saw to it then was just fun, aliens. and that's a very human thing to want to find something sort of lighter and kind of goofy when the news is like that. And I think it also helped that it wasn't very polarized.
That's a good point. Yeah.
Marco Rubio and Harry Reid both are really into aliens. There isn't an obvious, like, if we knew what the aliens wanted to do on capital gains taxes, maybe there'd be like a real divide there. But are there aliens seems fairly neutral. And
it's not a culture war divide.
I think it was a story that sort of filled a need that people had at that particular moment. And it's not just the New York Times that I think 60 Minutes did a lot with these
true.
Fighter pilots. A lot of people, I mean, hell, like even me writing sort of a skeptical piece on it was participating in this to some degree.
Yeah.
And I think that's like a real thing in journalism that... it isn't always a bad impulse. Like, it's fine to entertain people, but you can't let your factual standards lapse as part of that.
I think it's a really important point about these stories came out in two moments, like 2017 and summer 2020, when the news was really scary. And I was scared. Everybody felt really upset. And it's a fun diversion. I think there is also... I think it speaks to something deeper, too. I think when the world feels out of control, as it did in those times because of Trump, because of COVID, we are just much more prone to believe conspiracies in those moments. When things feel out of control, we kind of want to reach for these larger explanations, for these hidden forces controlling things, and that's why things feel this way. It's not just that the world is chaos. And there's also a, like... social media participatory element to this, where when we all feel scared and out of control, this is something that we can all come together and talk about, like aha, now we all see that the aliens are real, and now we see that Kate Middleton is, you know, the Mahdi, and she's come back, and that's why, you know, we're not seeing photos of her anymore.
Yeah.
And I think this sense of
heard
it, like,
that one, that's good.
Well, you're hearing it here first. We're breaking this news. Like, I found this Brendan Nyhan thing. It's our friend, you know, Brendan Nyhan, who's a Dartmouth University political scientist, who wrote in 2017, right around the time this story came out, about how conspiracy belief among Democrats were suddenly way, way up because conspiracies, even if they're unrelated to politics, fill this psychological need that gets created when the world seems, you know, very scary or menacing or out of control. And I think it's also important to talk about this as a form of conspiracy belief among people like us, basically, who do not typically think of ourselves as prone to conspiracy belief because, oh, it's not a conspiracy. It appeared in the New York Times.
Yeah, it's nice to have your one sort of pet theory. We had a running gag when we were coworkers at Vox about my deep belief that the UN Secretary General Dag Hammarskjöld was assassinated. And, and that felt and like, I kind of do believe that, but like, but beyond sort of the factual sort of stuff there, like, it's super safe. It's 60 years ago and no one cares.
Yeah.
And I think like aliens filled a kind of similar hole for people. I think the other thing is that it's at the one hand's kind of silly and off the beaten track. On the other hand, it's so big that it's in some ways like would be the biggest news story ever if aliens really were here and were interacting with us, because the world would turn out to not just be humans.
Right.
And I think there's ways in which that's comforting too, the way that kind of nihilistic, like, who even cares about Trump? Like, we're all going to be dead from global warming in 20 years. Stuff can be kind of oddly comforting for some kinds of people.
Right. Here's a conspiracy theory that's fun to believe in, that I have permission to believe in because it's in these big media outlets, and that makes all the things that are scary in the news, like Donald Trump or COVID, feel so much more manageable because they're so much smaller in response. I think it's really smart. And I guess it's a case for... while I have some complaints for the people who put this story on the front page of major news outlets, I guess it's a case for giving grace to people who let themselves maybe get a little carried away with believing in UFOs, even if there was evidence at the time that we probably should have been more skeptical. Well, Dylan, where can we hear or read you these days?
I'm a senior correspondent at Vox, so you can read my stories over there.
Great. Well, thank you so much for coming on to chat about this. I found it really helpful to kind of disentangle this story. When you see the whole timeline, it all makes a lot more sense. And even if there are not little green men out there yet, if there are, we would love to have you on offline. So please get in touch with us. We'll invite you on for it.
I can't wait.
Offline is a Crooked Media production. It's written and hosted by me, Jon Favreau, along with Max Fisher. It's produced by Austin Fisher. Emma Illick-Frank is our associate producer. Andrew Chadwick is our sound editor. Kyle Seglin, Charlotte Landis, and Vasilis Fotopoulos provide audio support to the show. Jordan Katz and Kenny Siegel take care of our music. Thanks to Michael Martinez, Ari Schwartz, Madeline Herringer, Reed Cherlin, and Andy Taft for production support. And to our digital team, Elijah Cohn and Delon Villanueva, who film and share our episodes as videos every week.
The living room is where you make life's most beautiful memories. But your sofa shouldn't be the one remembering them. The new life-resistant, high-performance furniture collection from Ashley is designed to withstand all the spills, slip-ups, and muddy paws that come with the best parts of life. Ashley high-performance sofas and recliners are soft, on-trend, and easy to clean. Shop the high-performance furniture in-store or online at ashley.com. Ashley, for the love of home.
You can host the best backyard barbecue when you find a professional on Angie to make your backyard the best around. Connect with skilled professionals to get all your home projects done well. Inside to outside, repairs to renovations. Get started on the Angie app or visit Angie.com today. You can do this when you Angie that.